Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio today on this Medical Monday is Dr. Matthew Lynch. He's a board-certified neurologist with Perth Primary and Specialty Center at Nathan Litauer Hospital and Nursing Home. He specializes in adult neurology. He joins us for the first time today. Dr. Lynch earned his medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He completed his residency in neurology at the University of Cincinnati in Ohio and completed a fellowship in neurophysiology at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. He's certified by the American Board of Neurology. Dr. Matthew Lynch, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Well, wonderful to see you. To be part of today's conversation, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And while there's lots of social media ways to get questions in, why don't you just email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so Matt, we have the phones are ringing already. There are two phones, and I just want to ask you a real fast question, and that is this. Your specialties are?
Well, I guess I would consider myself a jack of all trades of neurology.
Okay.
I generally see general neurology patients, and so that would include things like headache, Alzheimer's disease, other dementias, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and other movement disorders. You know, there are a lot of other things too, but that would be sort of a...
Who does stroke?
Stroke, yeah. That would be another main one.
Well, you must be a very busy man. There can't be that many neurologists in your area of the state.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's a lack of neurology in general.
Interesting. We have four phones. I'm going to try to start getting people in if it's okay with you, Matt.
Sure.
A lot of questions to ask you. Let's go to David in Ghent. Okay, David in Ghent, you're on.
Hi there. How are you?
Hi, fine.
Good. I hope you can hear me all right. I'm in my car.
Well, yes. Pull over. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. it's hands-free. Don't worry.
Okay.
I have myasthenia gravis. And I've been in remission for a couple of years, but it's come back. And my question to the doctor is, I have a prescription for pyridostigmine, and I'm taking that every 3 hours or so, and it seems to be keeping up with my current symptoms. However, I also have some Mestinon, which is, as you know, 180 milligram time-release tablets, and I'm just curious if I need to know why Mestinon would work if I only took a pill every 6 hours, or whether I took three pills every 3 hours. I'm just curious as to how the time release thing works and how I can gauge when I can switch from pyridostigmine to Mestinon.
All right. Well, that's a good question. If you don't mind, I'll just kind of explain what myasthenia gravis is.
Thank you.
Myasthenia gravis is a immune-mediated disorder. So the immune system is actually attacking the connection between the nerve and the muscle. So patients who have that will experience weakness, and it tends to be fluctuating. So typically, with more activity, it will get worse. Throughout the end of the day, it will get worse. So it's kind of a fluctuating weakness. The way Mestinon works, or pyridostigmine, it's the same medication, like you said, one is just a time-release form. But that works by allowing that it kind of boosts the connection a little bit. So there's a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, which facilitates that connection between nerve and muscle. So it prevents the breakdown of that, and it boosts the effect of the acetylcholine at the muscle. So now when you ask about time release, you're going kind of back to my medical school days, and My wife, who is a pharmacist, might actually be able to answer that question better. But time release works by usually there's some kind of coating which prevents the medication from being released all at once in your stomach or in your intestine. And so it slows the absorption. So you're getting a higher dose pill, but it will slow the absorption so that you ideally get a more steady level. You know, if you take a pill every 3 hours, that's immediate release, your blood level will go way up, and then your body will eliminate the medication, so it will come back down. But with the time release, you're trying to get a steady dosing of it. Let me just ask what your question was again. Was it when do you switch from one to the other, or what?
Well, I was on, this is kind of a complex issue, I guess, but I was taking the Mestinon because I took it before, and it seemed to, as you say, keep a level response, and I didn't have to keep taking the smaller dose pills. Okay, fine. But I noticed that it wasn't working as well in the middle of the afternoon, and I didn't know whether I could take a supplemental pyridostigmine, not knowing when the next bolus of dose I would get from the time release.
Do you have a neurologist?
I do. I haven't seen him in a while. I guess I better call.
Yeah. It's hard to kind of assess that. I mean, sometimes we will add a bolus of medication onto a sustained release form, but ultimately that's probably something, and especially if the disease is coming back, it may be that you need more than just the Mestinon. So I would probably see your neurologist on that one.
David from Ghent, thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Could you speak about pain windup in the MNDA receptors?
Is there a context that you have in mind?
Well, just in general.
That's probably something I won't be able to speak on. As far as the NMDA receptors and how it's related to pain.
What are NMDA receptors, Matt?
What's that?
What are they?
NMDA is one of the neurotransmitters. I mean, we were just talking about acetylcholine.
Okay.
So a neurotransmitter is a molecule that connects two nerves or the nerve and the muscle. It's the way that nerves talk to each other. And there's many, many different types of receptors, and we're learning more and more about them every day that goes on. Unfortunately, the NMDA receptor is a little bit beyond my jack-of-all-trades level. So I don't think I'll be able to talk to that.
Jim, we're so sorry. Next time.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to Maria in Olive Bridge. Okay, Maria, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question that's probably not targeted enough, but it's about the effects of pesticide chemicals on the neurological system. It seems to me, from my random amounts of knowledge, that a number of pesticides that are applied or sprayed to dogs or humans or in houses or whatever, I'm talking about residential, not farms, a number of them kill the pests by affecting their central nervous systems. And I know that jumping into a bigger picture, there could be a relationship, for instance, I don't know, between organophosphates, which they don't use so much anymore, and neurological, either Parkinson's or MS or whatever.
Okay, but now, Maria, give us
the question. The question is, what kind of more subtle effects do these have, and should we be worried? I don't spray anytime I don't have to, but sometimes people put poisons on their dogs, etc. So should we be worried about this, and to what extent?
It's kind of not a question. It's a very good question. It's an interesting question to me, because anything that involves the nervous system, including the last question, is an interesting question to me. But unfortunately, the types of things that I study and read up on You know, you have to pick and choose. And I pick and choose the things which I see every day in the office because that will have relevance to the patients that I see. So unfortunately, I mean, I'm probably not going to give you the best answer on that, but certainly the organophosphates have been associated with direct nervous system toxicity. So it affects the muscular system. I mean, it basically is nerve gas. I mean, they've used it as nerve gas. That's more of an immediate effect where you'll get effects on the autonomic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system that you don't think about. It's the part of the nervous system that controls your salivation, for example. So organophosphates have a lot of effects, including salivation and weakness. And those are immediate in terms of connections to MS and Parkinson's. I mean, I think there's going to either need to be more research on that or, to prove it. But that's not something that I'm aware of. I mean, it could be, but it's just not something I'm aware that's been proven.
Maria, thank you for raising
it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We will be right back. Phones are ringing like crazy. There's one free phone, 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital and Nursing Home, welcoming surgeon Dr. Bennett Tajobi, a general surgeon specializing in minimally invasive surgical techniques, NLH.org, Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh, master's in online RN to BS in nursing degree programs for adult students, postmaster's nurse practitioner certificates in adult and family health, MSMC.edu, Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. Premier Medical, hv.com. Snow Farm Summer, Williamsburg, Massachusetts. The New England Craft Program for high school students. Glass blowing, ceramics, digital arts, and much more. 2 or 4 week sessions, small group instruction. Snowfarm.org. And Rock On, hosting a musician's workshop July 14th through August 1st. Playing in bands, songwriting, recording technology, and more at Berkshire Community College, Pittsfield. RockOnWorkshop.org.
Why, this program is going fast. All five phones are in use right now. Let us go to Cheryl in Montgomery. Okay, Cheryl. Cheryl.
Yes, hello.
Hello, your question.
Hello, Cheryl here. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. Give your question, Cheryl.
I suffer from what I consider an extreme case of ADD, totally disorganized, can't finish any kind of task, won't go around like a crazy person, starting one thing, stopping another thing. I am on psychotropic medication, but these symptoms didn't really start until after a 7-year post-traumatic stress syndrome at work. And my mother supposedly had Alzheimer's. My dad and my brother had Parkinson's. And I don't know, I'm about ready to go into a trial for Parkinson's to see if that's in fact something that could be behind all this. I just am very desperate because my whole life is in total chaos. I finally had to quit my work because of the stress and the macroaggression of my supervisors. And I have to hold on to my life here. And I thought, I heard there was a blood test. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. I heard there was a blood test for Alzheimer's that was 90% accurate, but not for the public. So that's why I thought maybe if I went into the trials, they would take the blood and I'd find at least that much out, because I'm so desperate to get my life together for my children, who are younger than most people's children my age, before I die. And I just...
Okay, Cheryl. Yeah. Only because there are five people behind you, I wanted to just get to this question, which is there such a blood test? I had always heard there isn't. So I hope there is.
There is not. There are genetic tests. So there are certain genetic tests which can be blood tests. Mm-hmm. typically they're not ordered, and they're for two reasons.
What does ordered mean?
Well, typically a neurologist would not want or encourage you to get them.
You wouldn't order them, yeah.
No. Gotcha. And there's two reasons. Because there's two types of genetic predisposition. So in one of them, there are multiple different genes which could cause Alzheimer's. Those are relatively, you know, if you have the gene, you're probably going to get it at some point. But they usually also occur in younger people. And there's a family history, for example. So, of course, everybody these days is kind of coming down with it because it's very common. But usually you'll have a family history of a younger person, you know, in their 50s or 60, or early 60s with Alzheimer's. So in that case, if you had that family history and, you know, you were of the, you know, you may consider getting them.
Well, my brother came down with early onset Parkinson's. I know there's some correlation there, but that may or may not be a factor here.
Well, in terms of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, they're sort of two separate diseases. I mean, in Parkinson's, you get dementia. I mean, it will affect your memory. Typically later in the disease, so, you know, you're talking 10, 15, 20 years into it.
What are the symptoms before?
Of Parkinson's?
Yeah, well, I know the shaking, but do you shake for 10, 15 years before you come down with it?
Well, usually it's very interesting. But, I mean, actually, people with Parkinson's we're discovering have the very early symptoms of some sleep disorders sometimes, but usually the person will come in with Parkinson's, they'll have shaking on one side, some slowness, some stiffness. Sometimes it's noticed by the family member more than the patient. And usually that shaking will progress slowly over the course of 15 to 20 years. And toward the end of that, you start getting the memory problems. Now, there are exceptions to every rule. There are people who get the dementia early. There are other forms of dementia which are not Parkinson's disease, but they have symptoms similar to Parkinson's, which have dementia, you know, can have the first symptom with it. So dementia is not just Alzheimer's, and it's a very complex, it's a complex group of conditions.
Well, Cheryl, I wish we could give you more time. We cannot, and I appreciate your call because I love Matt's description of Parkinson's and how it develops. Thank you so much for raising it.
The correlations are puzzling. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. We'll go to Philip in Herkimer. Philip in Herkimer, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 59-year-old male who up until 6 months ago was healthy. I had two occasions at work where I had what they called a seizure, where my eyes rolled back in my head, my hands were flopping around, I turned all white. In the process of doing a bunch of tests at the hospital, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. I'm being treated for that. The hepatologists have told me that the hep C has nothing to do with the seizures. I had a neurologist, I had an MRI, and an EEG showed up a small irregularity in my brain, and I'm on Topamax 25 milligrams for that, and I'm just looking for a root cause, wondering what might have caused this in the first place.
All right. Well, so irregularity, do you have any more information about that?
Well, he just said there was a small area basically in the back of my brain on the left side that showed a little bit of electrical problem, and I'm sorry, I don't have any more information than that.
That was on the EEG?
On the EEG, yes, doctor.
So an EEG is, just for the listeners, an EEG is actually a brainwave test. It's kind of like an EKG of the brain. You put a bunch of electrodes on the brain and you measure brainwaves. And a person with epilepsy, often there will be an irritable focus of brain, which is firing its neurons abnormally, which shows up on the EEG. So really, it's kind of a nonspecific thing, meaning it doesn't really tell you the cause. It just means that there's an irritable focus in that area. And so then often we'll look at the MRI and see, do we see anything there which explains the irritable brain? And often we don't. So many times the MRI is normal. There's no clear cause. I will say it's unlikely that it has to do with the hepatitis C.
That's what they told me too.
I would agree with that. And then you know, Topamax is a seizure medicine. They all, you know, they're all about the same in terms of efficacy. But
is it all epilepsy? Right. You used the word epilepsy before. Is a seizure always epilepsy?
No, a seizure is not always epilepsy. But you've had two of them, correct?
Yeah, the first one I was sitting at my desk talking on the phone, and the room just started spinning. I got kind of, you know, groggy, and then after it happened, I believe my blood pressure had dropped. I got all white. I felt crap. Went to the hospital, had a bunch of tests. The second one was more severe. They actually told me that my eyes had rolled back in my head. My hands were kind of flapping around. I ended up in the ambulance that day and in the hospital. I can actually feel that little spot in my brain kind of like throb a little bit. So
that's very scary when that – if I've never had a seizure, but I can only imagine. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, it was, you know, so, yep.
But, I mean, probably the throb, I mean, it's hard to know what to make of that, but, it's not something you can usually feel in terms of the localization of it, but.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, I mean, Topamax is a good seizure medicine.
Yeah.
Philip from Herkimer, thank you for calling. Appreciate it
very
much.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, bye-bye.
Oh, okay, yeah. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Christy in North Adams. Christy, you're on.
Okay. I love this show. Thank you very much.
Love to do it.
Last week, my right ring finger, out of the blue, turned white, got very cold, was very, very hard, and I began to feel the tingles that I get with neuropathy in my feet. And the same thing happened to my left hand about 10 years ago. Do you have any idea what's going on?
Well, that also sounds like a scary thing. I would think it's probably not related to the nervous system in particular. The two things that I can think of that may cause that would be, one would be is if you had a problem with the artery. Well, for example, suppose you had a clot in your heart or a clot somewhere else in your body, and the clot broke off, a little piece broke off and blocked off the artery or arteries going to the finger. That would be concerning. That's one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The other possibility, which is probably more likely, is something that's called Raynaud phenomenon. And, you know, you can look that up on the internet.
But... Yeah, I have. It doesn't, I mean, Raynaud's that I've seen on the internet and actually seen with people, they get sort of a purple, almost mottling. And this is pure white.
Yeah, from you know, again, that's more.
Right, not having seen it, what are you going, I'm wondering if it could also be perhaps a small bit of cholesterol.
That, you know, that would be another vascular hypothesis. But, you know, I would definitely see your regular doctor about that to see if you need any kind of vascular testing. But Raynaud, you know, I wouldn't rule out Raynaud based on just the color.
Okay.
Raynaud is sort of defined as any kind of color change with fingers.
Well, what is it, Matt?
It's probably a vascular spasm of some sort. I mean, it's usually associated with rheumatologic diseases, which is another name for autoimmune. So immune-mediated diseases that affect the connective tissue, including blood vessels, things like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and then some other things that are more rare. Those would be rheumatologic conditions, but I would start with your PCP and see what your primary provider wanted to do.
Okay, I'm not concerned about it. It happened once in 10 years. But thank you very much. That's been helpful.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Dee in Glenmont. Dee, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Doctor. Hi, Alan.
Hey.
Thank you for taking my call. Back in 1997, I had a diving accident which resulted in a spinal cord injury, and I'm able to walk. I've subsequently had 7 neck surgeries. I'm fused from C3 to T1, and my muscles are constantly in spasm. And we're trying to figure out why they're always in spasm, which is causing a lot of pain throughout my body. And I also have fibromyalgia. But when I hit anything, just even lightly, or somebody touches my arm, it's just excruciating pain and just can't figure it out. Any ideas?
Yeah, this is it's not really a phone question, but I'll kind of pontificate a little bit.
Okay.
So anytime you get damage to the nerve roots as they come out of the spine, either in the neck or in the back, those nerves can become irritable and basically send your muscles into spasm. If you've had seven neck surgeries, was it? Yeah, you said
yeah.
C3
yeah.
to T1.
Yes.
There's almost, you know, again, you'd have to see the images and examine you, but there's probably damage to those nerves. And, you know, sometimes it heals up and sometimes it doesn't. And
right.
When it doesn't, unfortunately, we're just left treating the symptoms as best we can. And that would be, you know, for muscle spasms, I mean, usually you've probably been through all of this already, but usually we start with the muscle relaxants and you can use, you know, more powerful ones that are more sedating, and then you can get into some controlled substances that are muscle relaxants.
Right.
And, you know, and then we start thinking about interventional things, so people will burn the nerves or, you know, do things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I've been through all of that.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then people lately have been using spinal cord stimulation. I'm not sure so much about muscle spasms. But, you know, for pain related to neck injuries, you know, the theory there, well, you know, kind of my crude lay neurologist, jack of all trades understanding, is you put a stimulator, you actually surgically put a stimulator over the spinal cord and put some, you know, electrical stimulation there, which interferes, you know, black box, a little bit of humors there, but somehow the stimulation will interfere with the transmission of the pain signals from the affected nerve up into the brain, and probably, you know, there pain is very complex. So you have central pathways, which means circuits of nerves within your brain, which are devoted to pain, and it's interesting. And kind of counterintuitive, because sometimes when you stimulate those, you'd think your body might kind of turn it off after a while, but
right.
In fact, it works the other way around. And anyone who's had migraines will tell you, you know, you touch the hair a little bit, and
right.
you get, you know, excruciating pain when you have a migraine. It's because the nervous system kind of goes on hypersensitive mode when you're in chronic pain. So you've probably had some of that too. And so, but these stimulators and these, you know, kind of newer types of treatments may affect those central circuits of pain as well.
So,
you'd have to take a look at your MRI and things like that. So Dee, I hope that helps.
Dee, thank you
very much.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Martin in Henderson Harbor. Hey, Martin, we're going to have to go quick on this one because we're running up against the break. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for your time. My question is based on what we're hearing in the media right now. You're seeing a lot of reporting about not only dementia, you know, what we used to call senility, but also Alzheimer's. So my question is this. Is there truly a rise in Alzheimer's, or are we just better at separating the diagnosis of Alzheimer's from dementia or whatever else it could be? Or is this an alarming trend that we're now, you know, identifying?
Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I don't follow the news that closely. So
but people are living a longer time. I know that.
Well, yeah, and that's part of it. And also, I mean, you're seeing the aging of the baby boomer generation.
Sure.
So, you know, as the age pyramid, you know, becomes more straight and less of a pyramid, you're going to see more and more people in their 70s and 80s. And you know, if you look at the incidence of Alzheimer's in people who are, or the prevalence in people, you know, number of people in their 80s that have it, it can get up to 50% as you get close to 85. So, you know, that's 1 in 2 chance. If you live to 85, you'll get it. So I think that's part of the reason why, you know, you see Alzheimer's as an epidemic. And it really is a huge public health problem for which, you know, we need. And there, and, you know, I just went to the annual meeting of the American Academy of Neurology, and, you know, at least in the sessions I went to, nobody had really mentioned anything about an increase in Alzheimer's. But there was a lot of buzz about Alzheimer's and a lot of trials which are going to be going on in the future. So I think, you know, I do think that we're going to see some major improvements and maybe even be able to slow down the disease progression. You know, I hate to make a prediction because I'll be wrong, but, you know, in the near future, you know, I think we'll see that.
Well, there's an awful lot of pressure to get it right, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Martin, thank you.
Okay. Well, have a great day.
Yeah, you too. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, offering a graduate program in social work and graduate and undergraduate programs in nursing. Adelphi.edu. Ellis Medicine, providing preventative heart disease screening for women at the Neil and Jane Golub Breast and Heart Center. EllisMedicine.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. And Thomas Cole National Historic Site, Catskill in New York's Hudson Valley. Presenting Master, Mentor, Master, Thomas Cole and Frederick Church. Open Wednesday through Sunday, thomascole.org.
Well, we are back. Thanks to Zachary. Okay, let's go to Kathy in Chatham. Kathy, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. About a year and a half ago, I had abdominal surgery, and the surgeon nicked my femoral nerve. And I was told at the time it might be a year before it healed. And now it's a year and a half, and it's still extremely sensitive. I just touch my thigh. It's uncomfortable, and if any kind of pressure is put on my leg, it hurts. I was just wondering, am I going to have to live with this? Is there something that could be done?
That's a good question. So... I'm going to assume for the sake of, you know, the phone call format that the nerve is injured, the femoral nerve is injured. They and like the surgeon said, they can take a long time to recover. So it depends on the type of nerve damage that's done. There are parts of the nerves, just like there's parts of anything. It's kind of like a wire, an electrical wire. So you've got the axon in the middle, which is the copper part that actually conducts the electricity. And of course, in a nerve, it's not made out of copper, it's a cell. And just out of interest, and this is why I love neurology, that cell runs from the spinal cord, wherever it comes out of the spinal cord, all the way down to wherever it's going. So you've got a single cell running from your spinal cord, for example, down to your pinky toe.
When you say cell, you mean it's that big?
Is that long.
Wow.
So there's a little tail that's that long. So these structures are a little bit delicate, but they run, you know, they all run together, so they form a cord. There's not just a single cell for each nerve. There's multiple cells, but there's also a sheath around the nerve. So it's like an electrical wire. It has a sheath which helps it to conduct the electricity faster. If you get damage to the sheath, that recovers fairly quickly. If you get damage to the actual nerve, so when you say nicked a nerve, it makes me, you know, think of, you know, actually cutting through the nerve. That if you cut the axon, that takes a lot longer to repair, and sometimes it doesn't come back. I mean, for example, if you just cut it off and, you know, sever the sheath that the nerve was in, the nerve won't know where to go. It will just grow. It doesn't have a brain. It just grows. And it won't grow to the right place because it has nothing to guide it. But if the sheath is still intact, for example, the damage was less and the sheath is still intact, the nerve will actually grow through that sheath at a rate of about a millimeter a day. So to get from your spinal cord all the way down to your foot, or in your case, from your abdominal region to your thigh, it's going to take a while. So the surgeon was absolutely right to say this is a long-term deal. Now, if you're a year and a half out, it's starting to get to the point where you're probably, unfortunately, you're probably seeing the amount of recovery that you're going to get.
So there's nothing, you know, I could take or some kind of procedure that might make it go away or at least be more tolerable?
Nothing that I would recommend. I mean, in rehab scenarios of multiple trauma and people who have a lot to lose, you know, sometimes they'll attempt to take out nerves and splice them together and reconnect them to muscles. I think the likelihood of that being beneficial for you is low, and the likelihood of it causing further complications would be high. So it's probably not a good idea.
Kathy, I wish we could give you some more time, but I just want to try to get as many people in as possible.
All right.
I very much appreciate your understanding. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Linda in Saugerties. Linda in Saugerties, you're on.
Hi there. I have a question. If you're pregnant, about probably 4 months pregnant, and you're painting a small room with those not good paints, like the mildew-resistant paint, and if you have a reaction like a dizziness and like a bloody nose the next day, can that cross over and cause problems for the baby, like learning difficulties or speech delays? That's my question.
Yeah. You know, this is another neurotoxicology kind of question, just like the earlier one about the pesticides. And, you know, unfortunately, I can't say, you know, I wish I could say, absolutely not. But I can't say that it does either. You know, I mean, these are things where, you know, they probably don't happen very often. And you certainly don't have pharmaceutical companies putting millions of dollars into researching these questions. So, you know, maybe if you talk to somebody who specialized in the toxic effects on the nervous system of different substances, they might have more for you. But unfortunately, I just, you know, again, it's not something I see every day. It's not my bread and butter. So I probably shouldn't talk anymore about that.
Linda, thanks for the most interesting call.
You.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because this very morning there was a story on NPR about, I don't know if anybody heard it, but it was a story during Morning Edition about a guy who had a factory for making hot sauce. And the smokestacks were letting out some of the stuff, and people in the town were complaining that that these odors may be hurting them. And, you know, and there's a big fight going on in the town as to whether this should be in Texas, I guess, whether this should be done or not. You know, I mean, it's almost impossible till the right research is done.
Yeah, and that research is hard to do because, you know, of course, an association, just because two things run together, right, doesn't mean that one causes the other. And so to prove that, you've got to have, you know, this guy named, I think his name was Hill, but he was an epidemiologist, which are the people that study, you know, associations like this, had studied it or came up with a set of criteria, like how do you know that one thing is causing another? And, you know, it's, you know, things like the strength, you know, is it a prominent effect? Is it a strong effect? Is there a dose response? So people get more than one, you know, more likely to get it. And then, you know, of course, the gold standard is a randomized controlled trial, which you can never do, you know, expose people to the thing and see if, you know, see if they get it. But of course, that's unethical. So it's sometimes hard to answer these questions.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Caroline in Red Hook. Caroline, you're on.
Yeah. Hi.
Good.
I'm looking for possible relationship between tingling in the calves or ankles, the cause of it, and/or tingling and numbness in the hands. Whether it's related to heart medication in the one case, the hands, and whether it's related to something else when you're not on heart medication, when it's in your calves.
Now, which heart medications are you taking? If you don't mind me asking.
No. I'm looking. that would be omeprazole. Is that the right name?
Well, that would be for reflux.
Okay, I'm sorry. There's a statin, atorvastatin. Am I saying it correctly?
And atenolol. Okay, I doubt atenolol is causing any tingling. Atorvastatin probably does not cause tingling either, but, you know, actually, I should take that back. There are some people who have argued that it can cause neuropathy. But that is not something that I would say is accepted by neurologists in general.
What about Losartan potassium?
Probably not. But okay. the thing that the statin medication is well known to do is it can cause muscle weakness and muscle pain. But again, that's different than what you're explaining. One more thing I would say is that a lot of times, you know, if you have a heart problem, you have other problems too. And some of those other problems could cause neuropathy, particularly things like diabetes. And there are also other, you know, the most common cause of tingling in the hands would be carpal tunnel syndrome or, a neck problem, you know, pinched nerve in the neck, which goes down into the hands.
Not circulatory.
No, if you have tingling, it's almost definitely not circulatory. I mean,
what about if it's numbness in the hands?
Numbness, the same. So circulation problems will give you whiteness, coldness, things like that. But if you're pressing the nerve, you know, if, like your funny bone, there's a nerve that runs right there. And so if you're leaning your elbow on something, you can get that little tingling.
Sure.
And then, or maybe you wake up in the middle of the night with carpal tunnel syndrome because you got the tingling. It feels like a vascular problem, blood problem, because as the sensation comes back, you know, you take the pressure off the nerve. Mm. Now the nerve is not irritated. And now the sensation starts to come back. So you get that, you know, as the warmth and the sensation comes back in your hand, it almost feels like there's something flowing in there. Okay.
And if you're not a heart patient and you've got this tingling occasionally in the back of your leg, ankle area, calves, rather, below the knee, and you're not a diagnosed heart patient, is there any other possibility? Of course.
Well, there's a lot of possibilities. So probably, you know, if it's bothering you a lot, then start with your primary doctor and then maybe see a neurologist. But one thing that comes to mind would be pinched nerve in the back, for example. And you don't have to have back pain to have a pinched nerve. I mean, I saw a guy who felt like there was some socks between his, you know, he had a bunched up sock in between his toes.
I understand it.
No,
it wouldn't be
pain.
An early warning sign of MS.
Well, unlikely, but of course MS can cause tingling, but you know, it has to follow the certain pattern and you really should see a doctor if you're worried about that.
Okay. Carolyn, gotta let
you
go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Okay. Bye bye.
We are in the lightning round, as you all know. So let me ask you, here we got one by email. Someone once told me that taking magnesium supplements prevents nerve endings from unraveling with age. Is this true? And what happens when nerve endings do unravel?
Well, it's not true to my knowledge.
Okay.
I always preface everything with, or I always postscript to my knowledge because, you know, I'm not the expert here.
Yeah, and one of the problems are that a lot of people, I got into big trouble for this, and I'm going to try to avoid it a second time, although I believe it, that there are a lot of people hawking supplements of one kind or another. And when they do, and these are not FDA approved or whatever, they do their thing and then a lot of people hear it. It's that simple.
Yeah, I would say pretty confidently that magnesium is not an issue there.
Okay.
I mean, it'll cause diarrhea, but it's probably not going to.
It's one of the things you'd rather not have. Okay, let's go to Mike in Kingston. Mike in Kingston, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if I could run, I haven't been feeling well in the last couple of months. I'm wondering if I could run some symptoms by the doctor and see what his thoughts
okay,
would
be.
Okay,
but it's got to be real fast because we're into this lightning.
You've got,
go ahead.
You got it. On basically the neurological stuff, it's headache, lightheadedness, dizziness, poor balance, wooziness. I have ringing in my ears. But in addition to that, I'm, you know, fatigue, tiredness, shortness of breath. I've been nauseous. I get abdominal cramping. I have a sore neck, and it cracks and creaks my neck. A lot of stiffness in the joints.
Okay.
And I just came from my doctor. He gave me, although he's kind of not thinking that it's Lyme disease, but he gave me a prescription to get a Lyme test. But he also referred me to an orthogonal chiropractor. Is there anything else based on, you know, that those symptoms that I just gave you that you think I might
need
to look into?
Yeah, that is a very nonspecific list of symptoms. So, you know, I can tell you if you were coming into my office and I was looking at your chart, you know, going into the room with that list of symptoms, I would have to say the money is going to be in the examination. So, you know, just from hearing that list of symptoms, you know, it kind of could be anything.
Right.
I certainly would not think of Lyme as top on my list. Now, have you been bitten by a tick?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And of course, you know, people can have Lyme disease without being aware of being bit by ticks,
sure.
Of course. But you know, the constellation of symptoms, you know, is not screaming Lyme. And it's also...
Are you familiar with orthogonal chiropractic and what that is?
I am not. I mean, I have seen chiropractic work for pain conditions,
right.
and it's been studied for those. I mean, it probably also depends on what pain condition you're looking at. But so I will sometimes recommend it. But as far as orthogonal, that's outside of my knowledge.
Mike, gotta let you go.
Well, I appreciate the call. Yep.
Thanks, Mike. Let's go to Jennifer in Sheffield. Okay, Jennifer, it's got to be real fast. Sorry.
Okay, so we have a family history of FTD, frontal temporal lobal dementia, as well as ADHD. I am 44, and my father just passed away from FTD. And I am wondering if there are any cognitive and or sort of pretests to be doing to sort of guard for this. I understand there's genetic testing, which may or may not tell you anything, but, you know, is there anything that I can do preventatively to sort of keep an eye on things?
Well, I mean, is there, no, in short, the short answer is no. There's, you know, if it's in your cards, it's probably in your cards. There, with frontotemporal dementia, the genetic tests can be a little bit more helpful, though. So it may be worth talking to somebody about getting that if you think you want to know.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do.
Jennifer, thank you. Okay, let's go to Bob in Hudson. Okay, Bob, you got to make it real fast. Go ahead.
My wife had a root canal done recently, and now her eye twitches.
Yeah. is it related?
Yeah.
Well, did it come about, you know, immediately after the...
Yeah, pretty much, right afterwards.
Well,
I thought she was just winking at me a lot more, but it's not that.
I mean, there's something called hemifacial spasm, which can produce winking movements. You know, the people I've seen with that have generally had sort of a progression. You know, it starts and then it gets worse over time. But you know, some people don't notice it until, you know, an event happens. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to prove if a procedure is causing something like that. You know, I can't think of exactly how it would happen physiologically. So I guess I would say it's probably not related.
Okay.
Bob,
all right, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Yep.
Okay,
bye.
And a big apology to Lee in Stattsburg, who wants to know if Lyme disease can cause neuropathy. Can it?
Absolutely.
Can?
Yeah. Yes, it can.
Okay. And from Gene in Poughkeepsie, how do you assess sleep problems? Well, one way is you go to a sleep center.
Yeah, and again, it depends on what problem you're talking about. Are you talking about insomnia or excessive sleepiness? And there's a whole list of things that can cause those. But a sleep center would be the diagnostic test of choice, typically.
Okay, so Lee and Gene, I'm sorry we couldn't take your calls, but at least we got something. We are out of time, and I want to thank everyone who called in, apologize to those who were left on the line, as I just did. Also, thank our friend Dr. Matthew Lynch for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Topperson, creams designed to heal muscle aches, back, neck, and shoulder pain injuries, carpal tunnel, and more. Topperson.com. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. He's terrific. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. She's terrific. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I can't say enough about her. Make sure you take WAMC with you. Download our new mobile app for streaming audio, headlines, podcasts, and more. Just go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store, search WAMC, and install. Now remember about the lockbox. You know what? It's up to you. It's on you. As my boy Jonas always says, on you. If you put money in the lockbox now, well, then we're going to have a much shorter fund drive. If you don't, well, then we're going to be here. Well, could be a long time. So, and there's $25,000 if we can do this on time from Mr. Big himself. And let me tell you, there ain't no fooling around about it. If we don't make it, we're in trouble. And that means we got to get to 325. I believe this morning we were at something like 155. So we're moving. But the question is, can we make it? It would be a shame not to. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.